Hello, Canadian television nerds. My name is Greg David, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, a conversation with Elise Morgan. Elise Morgan is a writer of TV, games, and digital series. She worked on Assassin's Creed Origins, was part of the Season 1 team for Girls Action Animation series Mysticons, and is currently pitching for her co-created series Alpaca vs. Llama for the Independent Production Fund. Elise has worked on animated and live-action properties for kids, including CBC's Ollie, The Boy Who Became What He Ate, Rusty Rivets, and Bagel and Becky. Elise has an MA in popular culture and is a graduate of the CFC's Primetime Television Writing Program. We'll hear all about this and more in my conversation with Elise Morgan. All right, Elise, here we are. It's official. We figured out a work schedule where we could get together. And just to let everybody know that's listening to the podcast, it's a Friday night. And instead of relaxing, we're talking.
I mean, that's kind of like relaxing. That's basically the same as relaxing.
Is it? Okay.
Is it? Okay. I'm not typing things, so it's fine. I'm winning right now.
You feel it's a luxury because you're not having to type. You've been able to turn your brain off for the weekend.
Yeah, I don't have to like write what everyone else is saying really quickly. Like, okay, I got it. Yeah, I know it's happening now. Good.
I think the first time we met was at the Toronto Screenwriting Conference a couple of years ago, right? Or was it last year?
I believe we met before, but we definitely chatted extensively for the first time last year during the Toronto Screenwriting Conference's writing room intensive with Kim's Convenience, which, you know, say that 10 times fast, of course. Yeah. Which was a fantastic thing. And you got to sit in and watch our mad process over everything.
You know, it's fascinating. I've been writing about Canadian TV for a long time and been running the TVA website for the last couple of years. And it's still fascinating to me to go into a writer's room. It's daunting, first of all. But once you get in there, just because you feel like a little bit, you know, like everybody in the room is a writer and the writers are all cool. But it doesn't take long to be sitting in there and watching for the juices to start flowing and to start thinking of things. Like, you guys all came in, you had to come in with pitches. That was part of the gig. But for me, just coming in as an outsider, it was so fascinating at how quickly everybody just got going and ideas started to flow and the whiteboard started to fill up. It really was interesting and a real buzz. It was a buzz.
I think that's every writing room. Every writing room you go in and it's always like, it's very exciting until you've been in the writing room for like 6 weeks. And you're just like, please just end, just be done. We'll figure out what to do with that later. It's fine. But yeah, no, it's a lovely, unique experience that, you know, until you've done it, I don't think is something people can really understand. Because I try to explain it to people I know outside of the industry or in the industry and other jobs. And I'm like, yeah, the writing room, it's like this and this and this. And they're like, that's a weird cult you've joined.
Yeah, it's because it's so much of a secret sauce. Like when people watch TV, on the surface, they're being entertained by the actors on screen, the music, and all the things that are very visual to them. And they don't realize that group of people that are in a room hashing out all of these ideas and going off and writing these scripts. They just don't get everything that goes into making a television show in the first place.
If that's what they see, we've done something wrong.
Well, okay, that's a very good point. But I'm going at it from the fact that there's a room full of people and hundreds of people behind the scenes that don't get credit. Not that they're looking for credit, but it's just
everyone
there's
get credit. Everyone, like the crews work really hard.
Yeah.
The animators work really hard. Like everyone, like the directors, like all the way the producers, people at the broadcasting, you know, centers, because they're weird. No, they're not centers. But, you know, people who work in the broadcasters, like everyone's doing so much work to get this out. And nobody sees most of the work. Then they go up to like the lead actor, like, you did everything by yourself. High five, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So much. Okay. So before we get into some, the projects that you're working on currently and future projects, we're also going to talk about a web series that, that you're hoping to get some funding for. Let's get your origin story. How did you get into this industry in the first place?
I fell backwards into it like most people do. I was doing my MA in sociology of all things. And wow. I applied, I was just like, I'll just look at cultural studies and take a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And I applied for the Canadian Film Center, having never heard of it before, on a whim, having written two scripts, done. Like, that was it. I'd written one spec script and one original. And I applied to the CFC and got in. And that happened to the year that we worked on Orphan Black, which, of course, was also 2008. So the industry crashed,
right?
Which is kind of my origin story. Every time I like show up somewhere, I'm like, oh yeah, this is great. And then the industry crashes horrifically, which is a lot of fun. But it was actually one of the reasons I went into doing digital series was because of, you know, there was just no work. There was no work for anybody because it was 2008, 2009 and everything had imploded. So I started doing my own web series and kind of met people from there and just built that out until I eventually ended up doing kids animation, which is where I am now, which is just a ton of fun.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's like anything else. You look back and you're like, oh yeah, that led to that, that led to that. But like, you know, to look at it at the time, you're like, I have no plan. I don't know what I'm doing. But the plan is you just keep writing stuff and you hope for the best.
Yeah. But you said that you fell back in this job. What encouraged you to write two spec scripts in the first place?
I hated being a student of sociology. I was like, oh, this is, it was actually popular culture I did my degree in. And I was just like, yeah, I don't want to do this for the next, you know, 10 decades. And on top of that, somehow writing television was a more lucrative career option than going in to be a professor. Because that's actually the reality of that. And I was, I picked up of all things, Alex Epstein's book on writing TV. And that was the first book I bought, and I've told him this since, and it's always an odd story when I'm like, hey Alex, I bought your book first. He's a great guy, and it is a fantastic like first book reference, I think, for that. And I was just like, I'll just write these scripts. I didn't actually expect anything to come out of it. And I happened to meet Alain Mastai, who of course is fantastically talented, just an amazing, amazing person, when he was running the Kingston Film Festival. And he was like, have you heard of the Canadian Film Center? And I was like, no. And then he told me, and that actually got me to Toronto and got me meeting everybody and kind of, from there, I was like, oh, I have to write an original script too.
Yeah.
Right. I'll do that then. And I don't even want to say what it was, cause it was horrifically it was like one of those very, like, this is not possible to even shoot. Why did I write that? kind of shows, but it was a Supernatural spec script, which is great because that show is still not off air and I can still use that script. For
Well, what were the spec scripts that the two spec scripts that you had written? What shows?
Well, the one spec script was for Supernatural.
Yeah.
And then the original pilot was a very bizarre thing about a girl who could see code above people's heads. And that gave her some sort of, it was like very confusing. And everyone I pitched it to was like, that's very different. And it was such a great, like, oh yeah, maybe that's kind of interesting. And it was a lot of fun to write, but it was like, this is a show about a woman who sees computer code. And that was it. It's like, she sees computer codes, so she knows things that happen to people. The end.
Oh, well, that could have been a storyline for Mr. Robot or something. That's the thing that popped into my head right away.
Yeah, now, this was 10 years ago.
Right.
10 years ago, people were like, computer code, nerd.
You were ahead of your time.
Yeah, that's it. That's actually been the problem. I've just been ahead of my time all the way through.
What made you write a script for Supernatural? Have you been a fan of that show from the very beginning?
I watched every episode. I haven't watched every episode since because it's on season 40, I think. But yeah. I really enjoyed the show actually when it started out. It was everything, like, it was like crack just for me. I was like, great.
No, totally. Self-contained episodes, the first couple of seasons were very scary. Scarecrows in fields coming alive and killing people and things like that.
Awful.
They started to lose me when they started to do the heaven and hell storylines, angels and demons fighting each other for seasons on end.
That was the point of the show. That was what Kripke wanted to do, which is interesting.
Yeah. Listen, I'm not going to talk shit about Supernatural because I'm all caught up on it thanks to Netflix. And you can always zip through the scenes that you don't like, and I still really like the show, and I've liked it from the very beginning. So it's just,
you know, it's a bit of a delight to watch that cast because you can just see how much fun they're having, exactly. and they're still coming up with episode concepts, which I think is fantastic because that's very difficult to do. What, like, it's now season 14?
Yeah.
Whichever season it is, that's a lot of episodes to go, okay, let's come up with these, you know, these new ideas. So it's respect given is basically where I'm at with it. I'm like, wow, this is great. They're still doing it.
For sure. So you go to the CFC, and so did you come right out of that program and right onto Orphan Black?
No. So Graham actually pitched that. I didn't actually work on the show a couple years later because I was working on some other stuff. Okay. But Graham, I think it took Graham 5 years out of the CFC, right, when we did it, to get it off the ground. And a lot of the stuff that we worked on was still in there, which was, you know, really fun to see. You know, it was like, oh, a lot of those. And he came in with a lot. Like, Graham had been working on it, I think, for 5 years by the time he even brought it to the CFC.
Yeah, because he and John had been kicking it around as a feature film originally.
Yeah, and they had a lot of great ideas, and a lot, and he brought in a lot of that stuff, and so did John. And so we helped kind of with that room of, there was 9 of us, and a lot of great, lovely talent, some of whom, like Jeff Deske's on The Beaverton, mm-hmm. and Alex Levine was on the show for many years, on Orphan Black for many years, and Peter Rowley, the same thing, he was on Orphan for a couple of years. You know, many, many people that are still in the industry doing great stuff. It was, you know, it was a lot of fun to work on, but then Graham kind of had, it was 2009, so everything just tanked.
Right.
And so he was pitching it around, and that's when I was like, I'm going to start working on my web series, mm-hmm. which seems smart, but of course that was, you know, a 2 to 4 year endeavor for both series, because it was 2 different series we did. One was Pretty and Geek.
Yep.
And one was The Gate.
Yep.
And The Gate had 40 episodes. And then that finally came out in 2013, and Pretty and Geek had 8 episodes and about 45 minutes of content. Right. And that came out in 2012.
Right.
And so it was a lot of work to get that built and off the ground. And then a lot of work after the fact, just to do the convention circuit and the comedy circuit, just promoting the shows, which was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very different experience. And we had a writing room for that as well, for both those shows.
Okay, so before we get to Pretty and Geek and The Gate, I just want to ask one more thing about Orphan Black. When you were part of that at the CFC, was there any indication in your mind, like, I think that this could really work as a show? Like, was there kind of an excitement in the room with all of you saying, yeah, man, like, if this makes it to air, this could really be something?
I think, I mean, we all were very excited about the show. At the time, there was nothing like it. And there was definitely nothing like it in Canadian TV. So that was always a bit of a, oh gosh, like, this is, they're going to have to go and they're going to have to really pitch it. And when it finally, the big thing I think we all kind of knew was they needed to find somebody really special to play all of those characters, and finding Tatiana Maslany was just huge for them. And she was just such a great talent, that when we finally saw, like, when I finally saw the trailer, I was like, dang, like, this girl can just nail it. And it was really impressive.
When that first season came out, there was nothing else like it on TV. You know, I jumped on board right away. I loved it. I couldn't believe that this one woman was playing all of these roles. The storylines were tight. They were engaging. They, you know, every episode ended with a shocking ending. And then it felt so great because, you know, Canada pretty much embraced it out of the gate. And then the U.S. got into it. And I remember this sports writer, Bill Simmons, writing about it. And he wrote for ESPN before he went off and did his own website called Grantland. And he just raved about it. And it felt so cool to know that it was a Canadian show and that we had kind of, you know, caught on to this little thing first before the U.S. caught on to it. And that was a crazy ride. So much fun to watch that show.
Yeah. And I think that was the big thing. And, you know, when it was in the States, no one was like, this is a Canadian show. Like, nobody said, oh, hey, it's this Canadian show that's done well. It was, this is just a great show.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about Pretty and Geek. Cause you said that was a web series, right?
Yes. It's no longer on the internet. It was on for between 2012 and 2017.
So did you, in 2012, the IMDb credit is 2011. So is that when you were developing?
Yeah. 2011, I guess, when we released it. I started developing it while I was at the CFC, probably just a little bit after leaving the CFC,
but
I started on that show.
But web series are so common now. Back in 2011, were people talking about them?
They were. They were definitely talking about them, but not as much. And it was a very new thing. And it was still like The Guild had come out with Felicia Day, of course. Yeah. And that was like the big thing. Everyone was like, oh, look, The Guild. But the idea of a web series the way they are today, where, you know, you've seen these great shows that, you know, have eventually become shows like HBO's Insecure and everything like that, that wasn't really what they were. Mm. People were still like, how does this work? And what is this format? And, you know, and I actually released a book on how to make web series because of that, taking a lot of interviews that I'd done over the years for my now dead blog. it's gone away. Where I talk to people about like what they did like in making web series and what they did and what they found successful or not successful. And the book is absolutely free and you can still find it, but it came out in 2012. So it's a bit dated now. But people didn't really get it. Like I'd be like, oh, I'm making a web series. And they're like, oh, it was one of those internet vlogs.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, it's, you know, it's a fully scripted thing. And they're like, I don't get it. How does that work? So we had to kind of push through that a little.
So you did that because of the crash, like you said, but as a writer, talk about the advantages. You know, there must be a lot of advantages, but also challenges to writing for a web series because you're writing for, you know, what could end up being 44 minutes of, or, you know, close to an hour maybe of total content, but you're writing for maybe 6 or 7 minutes or even less than that for per webisode.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot shorter generally now. I mean, of course now there's web series that are, you know, 20, 30 minutes long or longer. You can do whatever you want online. So do whatever works for your series is what I say for that. But yeah, it was a real challenge, especially kind of at the beginning of my career, going like write as short as possible and get everything out within a 5-minute period. And The Gate was even shorter because it was a sketch series. So we had episodes that were as short as 30 seconds and as long as 2.5 minutes. So it was a really great exercise in getting out stuff that A, would get people's attention. The nice thing too was that, you know, the coolness of being a geek wasn't quite as hip back then. So, you know, now it's really cool, but back then, no, not quite so much. Pretty and Geek was about a bunch of, you know, lady D&D players.
Yes.
And so it was, you know, you can't really easily, of course, Dan Harmon has made a show about that now, but back in the day that was impossible. All these rules are gone now. But I'm also not Dan Harmon. Don't tell anyone. So it was a lot of fun to be like, okay, let's make a show about, you know, 4 women and 1 dude, which also wasn't, you know, we're talking 2011. This wasn't as common in a series format. You're starting to see that a lot more now. So it was a lot of fun to be like, hey, we're just doing it. We're making a show. And that series particularly, you know, a good chunk of our main crew were female as well. Like our director, Vivian Lynn, was obviously a woman, and our producer, Courtney Wilson, was amazing. Also a woman. So we had this very strong, fully female team, and it was a great, great experience on that side. So we had a lot more control and we said, okay, this is what we want to make. Let's just go make it. And no one was saying, no, you can't do that. You have to have, you know, whatever. Like we said, okay, we're going to make this, and we did. And then we brought it directly to the fans at the conventions, and fans of people like, people who play D&D and all that stuff. And we're like, hey, what do you think? And you know, it was a very intense reaction. We had people who would be like, this is awful. And we'd have people who'd be like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And it was, it was really exciting to get that very, you know, honest, quick response. right in front of you.
It's so interesting how ahead of the curve you've been, because, you know, like I said, web series now, like CBC is, you know, they've got a whole branch devoted to web series. They're, you know, they seem to have web series debuting every couple of weeks on their, you know, CBC comedy website or elsewhere. Everybody's into web series. And again, you know, the big announcement that CBC made last year was that they were going to have 50% of their directors for their shows were going to be female. And here you are working on a web series back then that was largely, you know, had women running the show behind the scenes. You know, and there's so many headlines devoted to having more women, you know, taking on roles behind the scenes. And yet you guys were already doing it with your web series.
Yeah. I mean, if they were to be like, hey, we want to give you some money, none of us would say right. No, I'll just say that. We wouldn't be like, oh, hey, we did that. We did that already. We don't need to do it now. No, we'll still do it. Don't worry. But it was, yeah, it was an interesting thing. Like, we were just like, okay, we're going to make this happen. And it's fantastic to see some of that stuff coming from the broadcasters now, because there was a bit of like, how does this work exactly? Yeah. Going on then, and they're now seeing it, I think, a little bit more positively, which is great. And the team at CBC is fantastic. They're doing great stuff. The comedy web series coming out of, you know, CBC Comedy is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, so let's take a little break from shop talk. One of the things that we do every other week, well, it's been a little bit more, it's been a little less than every other week just because of scheduling. But when Anthony and I usually get together, we talk about the news, the Canadian television news, what's coming up, the latest breaking news in the industry. And usually we record at night, and that means we're usually enjoying an adult beverage of some kind. Now, I've been kind of on, just before Christmas, I was kind of on an apple cider kick. I'm really enjoying apple ciders and trying out different ones. Tonight, I just have water. I just realized how boring I am because I just have water. But like I said, I like to enjoy a cider or maybe a craft beer or something like that. What about you? Is there something that you like to drink when you're winding down after a long day of writing or pitching to people? It doesn't have to be an adult beverage. It can be tea, coffee, whatever it is. Is there something that you like to have?
I mean, if it's a long day of pitching, absolutely, it's going to be like, give me a straight glass of whiskey and just the bottle. Thank you. No, actually, I love me a gin and tonic. And there's a great, and they should pay me at this point for the amount of money I've put into them. But there's a great Ontario gin company, I think called Dylan's, and they make this rose gin that's fantastic.
Yes, I have seen that. And so, I've seen that at the liquor store.
Yes, it's good. You should buy it and then tell them that I told you to buy it. And then maybe they'll start shipping me, you know, a couple boxes for free every so often.
Well, I will provide a link in the show notes because when I did that back with Pommies, somebody dropped by and they had dropped off a case of Pommies cider as a thank you. So I will definitely do that.
Pommies is also great. They're good stuff.
Yeah, I like to support local if I can, just because there's so many different options options in and around the Toronto area. So I love that. But I've definitely heard of Dylan's, that's for sure.
It's a great gin. And if you do like cider, you can always check out the Brickworks Cider. They've got a new restaurant that I saw.
Yes, I need to go and check out that restaurant. And yes, they have a seasonal cider case of different ciders that are out right now. And they make a really good cherry cider.
Yeah, I had that one. It's interesting. I'm not a huge fan of that one, but I like their peach cider.
Yes, the peach one is good too.
Yes. Also that. I don't just drink alcohol. Sometimes I drink water.
Is it artisanal? Artisanal water?
It's artisanal water. I get, you know, people to bring it up by buckets and then I let it age appropriately.
Very good. So you had mentioned Kingston before. Are you from Kingston?
No, I'm actually, everyone's like, where are you from? And I'm like, you don't want the answer to that question.
Are you from Delhi?
It is very complicated. I'm from everywhere. I'm from Canada. I grew up in Ontario, BC, Quebec and Alberta for, you know, two seconds. So a couple places in all those provinces. So it's best not to go into too much.
But how long you're in Toronto now?
Yeah. I've been in Toronto for over a decade.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Toronto's home now.
All right. So then, your IMDb page, well, we talked about this before we started recording. Turns out that, like I said, we're recording on a Friday, and it is actually, we're just about to finish off Canadian Screen Week here in Toronto, because the gala, the Canadian Screen Awards gala, is going to be taking place on Sunday. But just the other night, Mysticons was given a Canadian Screen Award for Best Writing for Animation. Sean Jara, who's the creator of the show, and you wrote for Mysticons, so that means that you are a Canadian Screen Award winner, right?
I mean, technically that's Sean's, but if we're going to say technically, yes, I'm already a CSA winner, because I worked on a project back in the day for GarageBand that won a CSA for best website.
So where have you put the GarageBand trophy, and where are you going to put the Mysticons trophy?
They didn't give me
I didn't think they did.
They're like, no, we don't know. One day I'll go and steal it, and I'll be like, this one's mine. You guys don't even know. And huge congrats to Sean, obviously. He did a lot of work developing that fantastically fun world to work in, and it was a lot of fun to work in. Of course, I was just actually nominated for a WGC award for an episode I did for Mysticons called Heart of Gold, and we're up against each other. So it's going to be a tough
night. That is going to be interesting, especially if you're sitting next to each other at the Writers Guild of Canada Awards.
I'll just bring a nose gun. He won't know what's going on. It'll be fine.
So let's talk about that experience of working on Mysticons. I spoke to Sean, and of course, for people that don't know, the show was originally developed for boys, and then it was switched around and then ended up being developed for girls. At what point did you come on board? You weren't around when it was still kind of in the ether for boys, were you?
No, I wasn't. I came on when it became a girl show and was much better. No, I'm joking. It was both versions were fantastic. I will say that. I know Steph Kalliner was on both versions, and I think so was Grant Sauve, but I don't know per se exactly who else was, but, I came on once it had been shifted off and worked on season one. And it was, it was a really fantastic experience, because it's so rare to get a girl's action show. Yeah. It's often the thing that people are like, no, girls don't watch that. That's kind of the response. You're like, no, girls don't watch action. They don't want to see that. So, growing up watching a lot of those shows, it was super fantastic to be able to work on a show like that. And it was, there was a lot of women in the room too, which is not necessarily common. And we did actual summit. So we were on the show for, 4 weeks kind of each time. We did like 4 weeks and then we were off writing, and then we did another 4 weeks on season one. So, which is a bit different, but for animation, that's not uncommon. Right. Usually in animation, they're like, here's a week, get everything done. And then go off and write. So it was really kind of, we had a bit of time to really delve into those characters and really build out those stories and those story arcs, which was fantastic, because we did go into depth on those characters, which you don't necessarily get in some of those boys' action shows. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, anybody that says that you can't do an animated TV show about girls, people aren't going to watch. I think Wonder Woman kind of blew that whole thing out of the water, didn't it?
It helps. There's also DC Superhero Girls, which is out right now, which is just lovely. Miraculous Ladybug, which is also really sweet and out of France. So there's, we're starting to get more of it again, which is great, but it's, it's like they forget, cause it's like back in the day, like Sailor Moon was around when I was a kid, and that's what that was.
Right.
And it's like, girls won't watch that. I'm like, man, I had like the cassette tape. I listened to those songs.
Yeah, my sisters were watching Strawberry Shortcake. Do you remember that animated show?
I loved Strawberry Shortcake. There was a new one, and I feel bad because I'm always like, but the original. And it just had so much heart. That cute 2D animation for that. The 3D animation is lovely too, but yeah, it's, you just look at it and you're like, it's so sweet.
Working on an animated show, there's a little bit of, I feel like there might be some added freedom because it's animated. You're not working with live actors. Not that there's anything wrong with working with live actors, but is working on an animated series just kind of a little bit different mindset, or is it all the same because a writer's room is a writer's room is a writer's room?
I think when you're writing an animated show, you have to make sure you're using the animation, which you know, generally the animators will be thankful for, or they'll be like, please stop. We can't make that. That is very expensive. What you've written right. there. You're like right. 50,000 people. There's different requirements in 3D and 2D animation. Mm-hmm. I've worked on mm-hmm. both, and like certain things are really easy. Like water is really easy, or a lot easier yeah. in 2D than it is in 3D. And I have now been the person who's like watching The Good Dinosaur being like, look at those water effects. And I'm like, please stop self, like calm down. But you get to do stuff like, you know, throwing an actor up in the air is dangerous and you have to be cautious. But if it's animated, you're like, and then they do a backflip off of this and then you do this, this and this and this, and then like explosion mm-hmm. happens. You don't have to worry about anyone getting hurt. Yeah. You don't have to really worry about the cost per se mm-hmm. of that. You're just like, okay, this is, you know, this is going to be our big set piece and it's going to look amazing. And then it does. And you're like, did it. Awesome. And if you're working on a comedy, the best part in animation is working on a comedy because you're like, and then he turns into a boat, right. and then he's an explosive catfish, and you're like, that's odd. But kids are sure. like, yeah, of course he is. That's totally yeah. what he is yeah. now. Whereas adults are like, gross, that's not possible. Unless they're watching Rick and Morty.
Right. Which, you know, a show like Mystic Cons is for kids, but also, were you conscious of adults watching too? Like, does that even enter into it?
I think you always want to, you know, you don't want to dumb it okay. down too much. And I think that's the danger when people sometimes start writing for kids, is that they're like, oh, kids don't get it. And I think kids will always get more than mm-hmm. you think they will. And you always want to kind of have something in there for the adults if they're mm-hmm. co-viewing. But you don't want to, it shouldn't be just for the adults. I think that's the thing to say, is that I think kids understand more than you think yeah. they understand, and don't just write for adults unless it's a primetime show, in which case.
Sure. Okay. Before we move on from Mysticons, like you said, you've gotten a Writers Guild of Canada nomination for the episode that you wrote. How does that feel? You know, we're friends on Facebook. So when it was posted, everybody was congratulating you, the same thing on Twitter. How did it feel to find out though? Like what was kind of your first thought?
It was weird. I think that was the thing. I was just like, oh wow, this is a bit nuts. And of course you're like, I'm not going to win. It doesn't matter, but a nomination is great. But it was really nice to get that because we worked really hard on the show, and I don't think it's just mm-hmm. for me, because we all broke mm-hmm. it together. Like for me, that was something that we broke together as a room. So it really is for everybody who worked on the show. So it's just lovely to get that kind of accolade for everybody. If I do win, I just hope I don't trip right. walking up. I think that was my first thought, was just, dear Lord, I might have to talk to some people. No one wants
to. So is it important to be nominated for something? Do you feel like that's something that's important to you, or are you happy to just be in the background and not get recognition other than the recognition of maybe your peers in the room and that appreciation?
I think everybody likes being nominated. Everybody likes getting like, you know, the high five, mm-hmm. like you did yep. it. I think that it's a lovely feeling, but it is also like, I've judged for the awards yeah. in the past, and you see it, you see like what gets nominated and what doesn't. And it's not necessarily like the best or whatever else. It's just like, there's different things that kind of go into it. So it's lovely to be nominated, and it's important, I think, that there are nominations in the mm-hmm. industry, because people so often, you know, they forget or they don't see it, and we don't take the time to really appreciate each other's work. So it's a lovely reminder to folks to go, yeah, that was really good, wasn't it? But I think we should do it just for everybody in general, because there is so much that is yeah. great in the industry mm-hmm. already. So it is a bit weird to be like, yeah, of course. But, you know, if you have somebody say, yes, you did it, you're like, yeah, I did it. I did.
It's interesting what you said, being on the other side. So what are some of the thoughts that go into the decision making when an award is being given to somebody?
I mean, I can't talk sure. to everything, obviously. I think there's a lot. It's hard in the children's category because, you know, you have preschool scripts, you have older scripts as well. So it is a bit hard to judge, like, you know, against each other, like a kid's comedy that's aiming for like a 6 to 11 audience versus you know, a young preschool script, which is sometimes for as young as two, it's really hard to judge, you know, what's the best here. And it sometimes is subjective. So that's part of it as well. And that's why they have many people mm-hmm. judging.
Okay.
So that's, you know, that's all part of it. And it's also like, who does nominate their own work? Because right. not everyone right. does. Which I would suggest, you know, especially for people starting out, nominate mm-hmm. your own work. Go out there and be like, you know, I did this. It got made. It was fantastic. And put it out there and see see what happens. Because sometimes we don't have anything. Right. Like last year, we didn't have any web yep. series for the Writers Guild Award. So it's always a bit sad to be like, but, you know, that is a great category filled with, you know, a lot of great options. So it's hard for me when I see it. And it's like, there's zero nominations. What is right. this? And then, but you know, you also compared the WGC awards to the WGA awards, where there's just so many mm-hmm. more categories. And then I sometimes wish we kind of broke it down a little bit more.
Right, right.
You know, we used to have a preschool award, and that was lovely because there was, you know, it's a very different kind of writing. I've done both, and it's like, you know, children's and preschool and everything else. So it is cool to see it, but it's hard. It's like, oh, what, you know, what do you decide? Like, you know, Letterkenny versus Kim's Convenience. Very yeah. different shows. They're both exactly. very good, but they're very different
and
shows.
And, you know, you bring up a good point about kids. You know, you got the children's programming, you've got youth programming as well. You've got preschool programming. I mean, you know, to say that there's just comedy and there's just drama. I mean, just when you get into the kids programming, there's just so many different subsections of that genre on their own. And it's just so fascinating to me, all of the great programming that's coming out of this country, but in particular, the kids programming. I don't think that side gets nearly enough credit than they should.
I mean, I agree. I personally think we have some of the best kids programming in the world, and it's all, you know, sold mm-hmm. internationally. You see great stuff that, you know, it's pre-sold internationally in some cases too, where it's just like, you know, this is literally in every country yeah. in the world and Canadians don't know about it. And you're like, but you know, it's lovely to see it get, you know, there is kids only awards that exist, but I sometimes do wish that it was a bit bigger of an award space at the WGC awards. They're going to call me tomorrow being like, exactly. what did you say? And I'll be like, no, it's great. But I've told them this. I think, you know, it can be expanded a little bit.
Do you know what you're going to wear yet?
Oh God, no. Something. I probably won't be naked.
There are always the jokes about people saying that you know, they have to dress up and actually go outside and they have to wear something nice, which makes me laugh.
I might wear my pajamas. They don't know. They haven't told me what I can't wear
yet.
Hey,
there you go.
I'll make a statement. I showed up.
Okay, so in the last few minutes that we have to talk, let's talk about Alpaca versus Llama, because when I met you at the Toronto Screenwriting Conference, I asked for your business card, and there was Alpaca versus Llama on the business card, and I still have the business card here.
That's what business cards are for.
That's right. Well, you know, I have been using it as a bit of a toothpick, but still. No, but
it's good quality.
It is good quality. This is very good quality. And when I was, I'm going to be doing a story that's going to be going up because everybody wanting to get web series done are now looking for money from the Independent Production Fund. And you are no different. And right now, actually, I'm going to do this story. And I'm going to link to Alpaca versus Llama, the trailer. But tell me about that project because, again, I got this business card a year ago from you, almost a year ago now. And so clearly this has been in the works for a while. So what's the genesis of this show?
So it did actually ironically come from my business card. I was meeting with a producer and I was like, I've got this idea, this idea, and this idea. And the gentleman's name is Simon Watson. He's actually a co-creator on the show. And he's like, all of that is crap. This business card, though, he didn't say it like that. No, he's lovely. He was like, this business card, this is what I like. And on the business card, for those who obviously haven't seen my card, is a alpaca and a llama with boxing gloves. Mm-hmm. And they're boxing. And he was like, this would be fantastic. And I was like, sure, that sounds great. And so then we actually started working on that. And we brought in another writer, Alan Resnick, who's in the IPF trailer. He's the lovely smoking jacket man.
With the dog, the stuffed dog.
With the dog. Just fantastic overall. And we worked on this very crazy, somewhat surreal, animated, like, you know, callback to these great animated series that we loved from when we were kids, like Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, and more, you know, more recently, something like Zig and Sharko, which is everywhere worldwide. And we thought, you know, like these weird animals, this alpaca and this llama, what would they be after? Well, of course, one of them has magic grass, and it's not about pot. It's just a briefcase full of magic grass, and it's tasty grass. And llama has the briefcase, and alpaca really wants it. And the backstory is that llama, the old grandpappy llama, actually stole it from great grandpappy alpaca, and the alpacas have been trying to get it back ever since. And it's a lot of backstory for a no dialogue show of just in the end. But we had a lot of fun working on it. And so we're hoping that the IPF will look at that and go, yes, kids would love this. And make the our very fun, animated, no dialogue, crazy show. That all came from a business card.
That's a great story. Why did you decide to go with no dialogue? Why was that important?
We initially actually had actually written a couple scripts with dialogue, and it didn't really add anything. And one of the things we found as we were pitching it around and kind of going over the concept was that, you know, the idea of this, like what we really liked was these, you know, the old school, like Looney Tunes kind of stuff where we don't talk, where, you know, it's like Ralph and, I'm going to botch the dog's name, Ralph and the wolf, like the dog and the wolf, the sheepdog and the wolf.
Sam.
Sam. Yes. It's Sam. Sam is the dog's name. So Sam and Ralph with their clocking in and clocking out. And of course they don't talk until they clock in and they clock out. And what we loved was those, you know, those internal, you know, craziness of the animation of them, you know, each time trying something different and new. And with dialogue, we're like, okay, I mean, like we'll add dialogue, sure. But it wasn't really adding anything to the show. So we're like, okay, let's just get across what we can with sound effects. And it's done it, you know, for what we've read. Of course we think it's great. And I'm sure other people will think it's great. But it's a lot of fun, and it is a challenge too. It's a lovely challenge as a writer to sit down and go, okay, what can we do? What can we get across with sound effects, with growls and grunts and everything else?
So what does that script look like? It's just all direction.
It's a lot of direction, and it's, you know, anytime there's dialogue, so it'll be like, and it'll be like, well, what is he trying to get across? That I'm the voices. Thank God I'm not an actor. They'll be like, no. You know, like you've got alpaca making a growling noise, and it's like, well, what is he getting across? Well, he wants Sasquatch, his lovely sidekick, to grab something. So how do you get that across with a sound effect?
What's the audience for this? What's the age group?
Me. It's just for me. No, really just for us. We're going for kind of like that, you know, 4 to 8 or like a little bit older, 6 to 11 audience. And of course with a co-view. And I think that's the thing is that like parents, they all grew up on Looney Tunes. They all saw this stuff. So they know what this is. So we're kind of hoping that it's something that we can do with a co-view as well. So parents aren't going to be like, what are you watching? This is, you know, atrocious. They go, oh yeah, this is great.
Okay. So I'm going to put the link to the trailer in the notes for this so that people can check it out. So what's the next step? Yourselves and a whole bunch of other people are all going for this funding. So once you get, if you're approved, what's the next step for Alpaca versus Llama?
So we go from, this is phase one right now. So we go from phase one to phase two, and that's when there's a bunch more paperwork, a bunch more scripts, all that stuff. And we actually have a lot of that stuff already written. And we submit that, and then they have another jury that goes through it, and they decide, I think, in June who gets funding. And then if we get funding, then, you know, then it's to the storyboards,
right.
To the storyboard machine, make everything right. happen. And working with our animators to really make this stuff, you know, pop. And then we put it on the internet and everyone loves it and we get famous. That's current business. That's make more.
Who, and would you use the same animators?
Yeah. I mean, for what we have right now, those were just storyboards. So, so we worked with some great, talent on making those storyboards. So we'll have to be moving into working with a full animation company to build it out. So that's kind of the next step. And we have everybody, we have that pipeline built. It's just waiting.
That's the killer, right? Like I spoke to so many people last year for this, for the story that I wrote and everybody was ready to go. Everybody had the scripts for the next step. It's just like, okay, the deadline's coming. We're hoping to get eyeballs to the trailers. Please watch our trailers and like them. And then there's that waiting game. Now there's always a waiting game when you're making television, but when there's a big pot of money on the other side of that line, there's even more, you know, stress involved, especially when you're, you know, you got to get as prepared as you can. I guess it's like sports, right? You're at the starting line. You got everything that you need. You just wait for somebody to say go and then hand you a big bag of money on the way.
Yes, I mean, I think that's what most athletes are actually after. They're like, where's that bag of money?
And it's a bag with the dollar sign on the side of it.
I mean, that's what I was imagining. I hope nobody else was thinking of anything else.
Okay, so good luck with that. Okay. And then to wrap up, a question that I like to ask people is the type of television that you watched when you were a kid. For me, I was a late 70s, early 80s kid. So it was the Hardy Boys. It was the Incredible Hulk. It was the A-Team, Magnum P.I., shows like that, that I watched. I did watch BJ and the Bear. Yeah, Greg Evigan.
That show is so weird. It's like my favorite thing. I'm like, especially if I meet people younger than me, I'm like, watch the trailer for BJ and the Bear. And they're like, what is that? And I show it to them. And they're like, how did this get made? And I'm like, I don't know.
You know, you could say that about a lot of the shows in the 80s. You could just say, how did this get made? And, you know, because like the Dukes of Hazzard, I mean, there really wasn't a lot of story with regard to episodes of the Dukes of Hazzard. But what were you watching?
I don't want to age myself too much, but I definitely watched, let's see, what's new?
Yeah,
I watched
that's right. Ben 10. The 100. No,
the 100 when I was a kid. I watched, right. as I mentioned, Sailor Moon. I definitely watched Sailor Moon a lot. Mm. I watched mm-hmm. She-Ra and He-Man. Mm. And those shows were great. I think my favorite, like, nobody else has ever heard of it show was Lady Lovelilocks, which was the toyiest of toy shows about a character who was blonde and had streaks in her hair that turned into creatures. And her enemy was a girl with dark hair. And her name was Duchess Ravenlocks because she was bad.
I have never heard of the show. I just looked it up. Lady Lovelilocks and the Pixie Tales.
And the Pixie Tales, yeah. And it's the most bizarre show ever. It was just like so weird and it was only on for a season. And I just have such vivid memories of watching it because I had, we didn't have TV. So I had like one cassette tape that I watched over and over again. And there was two episodes of that show on it.
It was created by the American Greetings Corporation.
Mm-hmm. It was created by a greeting card company. Fantastic.
Again, ahead of their time because now we have a whole channel called Hallmark.
They knew what they were doing. They were getting them young. They're like, okay, 20 years from now,
you mentioned all shows, some of the formative shows when you were growing up, all animated shows. So I guess it makes sense that you're involved, you know, that your latest project has to do with animation.
Yeah. And I mean, I love animation. So I've gone back to, and I'm like, these shows are great. But I definitely watch cartoons, like a lot of cartoons, probably to the point where they were like, stop watching that. And I'd be like hiding, watching.
What about now? Do you still watch a lot of animated programming and children's programming just to stay on top of the trends and to be inspired?
I do. I was ridiculously excited this week to see that Infinity Train had been picked up because I watched it 2 years ago when the short was released. And it's just a fantastically unique concept. And I was just like, oh, yes, it's finally getting made. So I definitely keep up with all the new stuff that's happening and love, like, I love to see the new every year Cartoon Network and Nick has their animated shorts that they release, which is primarily with, I believe, their a lot of animators that they've you know, kind of had working with them over the years. And they go make something and then they just make this beautiful thing and they put it online. And then a couple years later, they're like, oh yeah, I guess we could make that. So, which is, that's a much longer waiting period.
And what are you watching now aside from those, from something like that? What are you watching?
I just started watching the new season of Jessica Jones, which dropped yesterday, and I'm quite enjoying it. And I'm desperately waiting for the new episodes of Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine fan.
Such a good show. That and The Good Place. That guy can do no wrong. Like, everything he's created in the last couple of years, I was like, this is amazing.
A big thanks to Elise Morgan for taking the time to chat about her career with me. You can find all of our podcasts at tva.com. Just click on the podcast tab or subscribe to the podcast via Apple or Google Play. That wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.